The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, the gathering of top diplomats from Israel, Egypt, the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, as well as the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Palestinian-occupied territories referred to as the Naqab Desert, has provoked strong reactions from Palestinian resistance groups, calling it a symbol of cooperation with Israeli plots and occupation. In this edition, we will be discussing what is behind this move and what it means for Palestinians fighting for their freedom. My guests for tonight's show are Palestinian Solidarity Campaign Mick Napier from Edinburgh and human rights advocate and Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan from Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Mr. Napier. Now, this meeting is being held in the occupied territory of the Naqab Desert. Isn't this another stab in the back of the Palestinians?
It's not secret anymore. It's not furtive anymore. The Saudi regime is still keeping in the shadows. It's deepening alliance with Israel. But this is now out in the open. And it's clear that these regimes have decided that there's nothing that Israel will do which will cause them to end their diplomatic relations, their normalization. It is absolutely incredible that a regime led by Naftali Bennett, who will be one of the hosts for the event, a man who said famously, "I've killed many Arabs and I don't have a problem with that," is now hosting the leaders, the foreign ministers, of three of the Arab states in the region. And it's also interesting, by the way, that they're meeting Ben-Gurion's old ranch, I forget what it's called, something Sofer, because Ben-Gurion was very clear that there were no limits to Israeli expansion. He very clearly stated in a biography by an Israeli politician of him that there was no limits to be placed on Israeli expansion except that which could be achieved by military power. So these foreign ministers are meeting to really give a green light to Israel to commit increasing crimes against the Palestinian people, and also, I think, to cause Israel to become stronger, which ultimately will be a threat to not just the Palestinians, for whom it's a deadly threat, but for the whole region.
Exactly, Mr. Napier. That's absolutely correct. And Ms. Wahdan, as Mr. Napier mentioned, the presence of politicians of this caliber will obviously embolden Israel and encourage more atrocities against Palestinians. What is the motive of these Arab leaders who were once considered supporters of their Palestinian brothers and sisters, and how far do you think they would go?
I think this shows that these Arab regimes have reached a bankruptcy, a political bankruptcy, total political bankruptcy. This summit of shame, as we call it, is not going to bring any security for the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. It's not going to bring anything for the Gulf states as well, for the Egyptians and for the Moroccan together. The people of these countries actually are anti-colonialization, anti-normalization with the colonial apartheid Israeli regime. So they couldn't achieve anything after they publicly started normalizing with apartheid Israel. So it seems like Israel is going to be gaining some moral, let's say, achievements. On the ground, there was a big demonstration in the Naqab area on the Land Day. That's the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine, which is going to be celebrated on the 30th of March. It is coinciding with a military operation that was run or executed by a Palestinian from Bir Sheba, which is Bir Sabah in the Naqab. So all these actually the resistance and the confrontations by the Palestinians is accelerating as well to defy and to confront the Israeli acceleration of their aggressions against the Palestinians in all of Palestine. The Naqab is in 1948. The people of the Palestinians there have been facing land confiscations since 1950. And the Israelis continue to expropriate more lands from the Palestinians, continue to destroy villages for the Bedouins there, like Al-Arqub, for example. It was destroyed over 200 times, and it was rebuilt again by the Palestinians. So all these measures, harsh measures, aggressive measures against the Palestinians will create resistance, will create confrontation. And this confrontation has been accelerating in the Naqab area in particular, as in all Palestine, but particularly Naqab area, and the Palestinians there has been confronting all these measures day after day. So what we are seeing is all of Palestine is going to be confronting the Israelis on Land Day and afterwards during Ramadan month. So all these accelerating, as Israel has been saying just a while ago, the Israeli army is being put on alert because they are expecting some sort of missile attack against the summit, the shame of the summit of shame in the Naqab area, which means that Palestinians in total are refusing this summit to be taken place on their occupied land, and continue to stabbing Palestinians since actually the establishment of these monarchies as a functional state. In the few decades after the oil. So the United Arab Emirates has been established in 1972. Our connection with the land in Palestine goes back to 10,000 years, and the United Arab Emirates have been established 1972 by the will of the British colonization in the Gulf and in our area. So there is no doubt for us that these countries are going to face, even in their countries, they're going to face confrontation, and they're going to lose the game with the Israelis. The Israelis here to gain more money from the Gulf states, while Ms. they Martin. Are going to lose
I'm sorry, our time is limited, so let's go over the questions faster. Mr. Napier, I would like to ask you this question. The normalization with Israel, what does it mean for the Palestinians who are fighting for freedom, and what options are they left with to realize their goal of liberating their occupied lands?
I think they realize who their friends are and who their enemies are. Look, I think this takes place against a background of a crisis inside Washington. Washington is interested above everything else in confronting China. That's the big foe, and everything else that detracts from that is a problem. America is drawing down its attention, its investments, military and economic and political in the Middle East. And therefore the question for the Gulf Emirates like the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and so on is, who will protect them from their own people? Who will protect them from external enemies? And they have decided that the best substitute for American intense interest in the area is Israel. So they're gravitating towards Israel because they correctly see Israel as an extension of American power into the region. I don't mean that Zionism is completely loyal to America. Far from it. Zionism is for hire. It's not for sale. But it has been for hire to the Americans for a very long time, and that link remains strong. And therefore, if the states that were previously or up till now have been guaranteed with defense agreements with the USA are to look towards the future, they see that future as moving closer to Israel. Now, of course, there's lots of dirty poker. Morocco is going to be there because in order for Morocco to rubber stamp the dispossession of the Palestinians to give a green light to Israel, Israel and America gave a green light to Morocco to suppress the United Nations endorsed right of the people of Western Sahara to self-determination. This Sudanese government won't be there, but they've also signed a normalization deal with Israel. But that's a problem because there is a very powerful popular movement in Sudan which has prevented the Sudanese government from opening an embassy there so far. So for the Palestinians, they understand deeply and profoundly there's no alternative but resistance. Resistance in all its forms. Because actually the Israelis do not, at the end of the day, offer anything to the Palestinians except doom. Their expulsion, their replacement by Jews from around the world, or if there's not enough Jews from anybody else, as long as they're not Palestinians, and therefore they have to resist. And when they resist, they will find that the peoples of these states, the Egyptian people, the Moroccan people, are their allies, but the Moroccan and the Egyptian governments are, of course, their bitter enemies, tied very closely to America. And they're moving. The summit in the Negev, where if they look out of the window of their very exclusive hotel, as your other guest said, they will be able to see and smell and feel the rage, the ethnic cleansing which is taking place in the Naqab, a clear plan by the Israelis to remove the Palestinian Bedouin, many of whom have been involved in agriculture for a very long time. I mean, do your viewers know that in the Naqab, the Palestinian agriculturalists have faced Israeli government aircraft spraying poison from aircraft onto their crops, and the plan is to drive these people into concentration zones, terrible, poor, miserable, in order to free up most of the land surface for Jewish colonization. That's what these foreign ministers will be in the middle of until Monday, I believe. So the Palestinians have no alternative but to resist. Means possible, and they need the support of the masses of people in the Middle East and the masses of people around the world, like the California dockers who refuse to unload Israeli ships. If that spreads, Israel can be defeated ultimately.
Thank you very much. Now, Ms. Watton, do you think that there are any prospects of this summit leading to some kind of conclusion that may affect the political equations of the region?
Well, I think, first of all, the Israelis will not get anything out of this summit. The Israelis are facing existential threat in Palestine as well as in the region. The axis of resistance and the Palestinian resistance from one side are combined together to confront the Israeli expansionist policy. And they feel, the Israelis feel, that this threat is getting closer and closer, and they're losing their battle with the Palestinians as well with the Arab nations around us and in the axis of resistance countries. So they have no future here except two choices, to leave the country here or to live as citizens without, you know, abolishing colonization, abolishing apartheid. This is the only choice that they have. But I think that the leaders of this apartheid regime is pushing even their own people to a confrontation, to a deadly confrontation with the Palestinians. And eventually, as we witnessed last May, during the sword operation, that the population, their population, the Jewish population, were afraid to stay in their homes. And the people of Lod, for example, in 1948, were trying to escape their city and go to other safer places. So what we are seeing very gradual and steadily, that the Israelis are retreating, although they are disclosing their plans to connect the West Bank to what they call Israel. But on the ground, they're facing more and more resistance from the people. An hour ago, as it was aired just a minutes ago, there was an operation south of Haifa in 1948, where four policemen were shot by Palestinians, and four of them are having serious wounds. So what we are seeing on the ground in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Jerusalem, include also in 1948, more and more resistance to the Israeli measurements, harsh measurements, and aggressive measurements against the Palestinians. They think that they can suppress 7 million people in historic Palestine, and what they see is more and more resistance, more and more confrontations. So what I see in the near future, that the Palestinians will win this war and the Israelis will retreat. We'll win this war against the apartheid Israel.
Well, thanks, Ms. Watson. Mr. Napier, the summit has been called at a time when the parties to the JCPOA are very close to reviving the deal. Do you think this summit can in any way jeopardize that?
You know, it's almost impossible to call. It looks like they can't. It looks like Blinken is going there to tell his client states, the Arab foreign ministers, that this deal will go forward. And he's using all sorts of forms of words, threats against Iran, in order to tell them that there's no alternative but the acceptance of the JCPOA. So I'm not an expert in that field, but everything seems to point in that direction. And if I could just add a few things. These Arab foreign ministers are meeting there with Blinken, with the Israeli government leaders, who are gloating at this. The very fact of this meeting is a stick for them to beat the Palestinians with, to say to the Palestinians, look, we have relations with these governments. You are alone. You're isolated. You ultimately will face defeat. But as our other guest has said, that's not the case. The people who win in an anti-colonial struggle like this are not those who have massive violence and massive technology and an overwhelming military edge. That was the case in Algeria. The French won the military confrontation in Algeria. It was popular revolt which drove them out. And I think this will be this will be the case again. In case after case, it's not the people with the great violence, that's the Israelis who win, hands down. It's the people who can accept the suffering, the pain, the agony that the Palestinians are going through and still continue to resist. And these foreign ministers cannot give Israel the legitimacy which it craves. It craves legitimacy. It's born in blood and ethnic cleansing, and it craves acceptance by the world. But the only people who can give Israel legitimacy are the Palestinians, and they will not do so. Our other guest has shown eloquently that resistance is rising. If you look back at last May, when there were moves against Al-Aqsa Mosque, fascist gangs in Israel were attacking Palestinians, rockets from Gaza challenged the Israelis in a way that they never expected, and it created a degree of unity among the Palestinian people I haven't seen for a very long time. So yes, I agree with your other guest. Israel can be defeated. It depends on Palestinian resistance and other actors in the region and beyond coming to their aid.
Mr. Napier, that was a great example, Algeria right there. You pointed that out. And Ms. Vatan, the Abraham Accords are a rare Trump-era policy that was fully embraced by Biden's team. What does this mean for the Palestinian resistance group? And we have only 1 minute left.
Yeah, well, the U.S. administration's policy towards Palestinians and in other areas of the world, it hasn't changed. With Biden, with Trump, with Bush, with Obama, it's the same policy. You know, who runs the USA foreign policy is the industrial complex, is the financial companies, and it's not the people who elect. It's not the parties, it's not the Democrats or the Republicans, it's not the people who elect their representative to make these foreign policy. There is the deep state which puts forward this foreign policy, and it doesn't change whether it's Abraham agreement was signed during Trump, Biden has blessed it and went forward with it. The USA embassy in Jerusalem is there to stay. The Biden administration didn't move it back to Tel Aviv. So their policy is just the same. Who decides is mainly the military complex in the USA. And we're going to see the same treatment by the USA. Blinken is here to order Palestinian Authority to go ahead with their policies here. As I said before, the people on the ground, the people who are confronting the Israeli occupation.
I'm sorry, we're running out of time. So I saw Mr. Napier also nodding, agreeing with Ms. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and Palestinian activist who joined us from Ramallah, and of course from the Scottish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight. And thanks for following us.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright. and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Suratul Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَإِذَا رَأَوْكَ إِن يَتَّخِذُونَكَ إِلَّا هُزُوًا أَهَذَا الَّذِي بَعَثَ اللَّهُ رَسُولًا
And when they see you, O Muhammad, they take you not except in ridicule, saying, Is this the one whom Allah has sent as a messenger?
إِن كَادَ لَيُضِلُّنَا عَنْ آلِهَتِنَا لَوْلَا صَبَرْنَا عَلَيْهَا وَسَوْفَ يَعْلَمُونَ حِينَ يَرَوْنَ الْعَذَابَ مَنْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا
He almost would have misled us from our gods had we not been steadfast in worship of them. But they are going to know, when they see the punishment, who is farthest astray in his way.
Brothers and sisters, we reached the 42nd verse of Suratul Furqan. إِن كَادَ لَيُضِلُّنَا عَنْ آلِهَتِنَا لَوْلَا أَنْ صَبَرْنَا عَلَيْهَا وَسَوْفَ يَعْلَمُونَ حِينَ يَرَوْنَ الْعَذَابِ مَنْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا He would have led us astray from our gods if we had not been stanch to them. And soon they will know, when they see the chastisement, who it is that is most misled in path. This holy verse, dear listeners, is mentioning the rest of the pagans' words. You may remember, they used to ridicule the Holy Prophet, they used to ridicule the concept of messengership, but it was through the denial of the Holy Prophet himself. أَهَذَا الَّذِي بَعَثَ اللَّهُ رَسُولًا The 41st verse said, Is this the one whom Allah has sent us a messenger? So they used to seek different pretexts. First, they called him insane or bewitched. And then they continued finding different pretexts, like why does he eat like us? Why does he walk like us? Why doesn't he have an angel accompanying him, etc.? And they did not want to accept the truth about hereafter. بَلْ كَانُوا لَا يَرْجُونَ نُشُورًا They did not hope to be raised again. They hoped not to be raised again, to be put better. And this is what stopped them from seeing the truth. Anyway, this verse continues saying, إِنْ كَادَ لَيُضِلُّنَا عَنْ آلِهَتِنَا لَوْلَا أَنْ صَبَرْنَا عَلَيْهَا The polytheist and the pagans, better say, will continue their argument, saying, He would have led us astray from our gods if we had not been patient to those idols, better say.
حر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, the first point we understand from this beginning part of the verse is that patience and resistance is not always an essentially a value and merit. If you are patient, if you are resistant in the wrong path, this cannot be counted as a value. Sometimes it is stubbornness. Sometimes it is obstinacy, such as resistance and patience in being misled and deviation. So they say, it is really good that we stood with our idols. إِنْ كَادَ لَيُضِلُّنَا عَنْ آلِهَتِنَا. He would have led us astray if we had not been careful. But the Holy Quran answers them in some ways. In first answer to this group of people who were not logical, with a striking sentence, the Holy Quran says, وَسَوْفَ يَعْلَمُونَ حِينَ يَرَوْنَ الْعَذَابِ. Soon they will know, when they see the chastisement, مَنْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا. They will see who is it that is most misled in the path. This chastisement that the Holy Quran discusses may refer to the punishment of hereafter. So when the verse says, وَسَوْفَ يَعْلَمُونَ حِينَ يَرَوْنَ الْعَذَابِ, the word عَذَاب might be talking about the punishment of hereafter, as some commentators such as Tabarsi in Majma'u al-Bayan believe. It might also be the punishment of this world, such as defeat in the different battles of Badr and the like. And this is what other commentators like Qurtubi in his famous commentary says. And it may also refer to both of them. Mentioning one of them as meaning does not restrict and limit the generality of the verse. Yet, the interesting fact about this group of misled people is that they presented contradictory words. On one hand, they ridiculed the Holy Prophet ﷺ, they ridiculed his call, and they wanted to say that the claim of the Prophet ﷺ was so baseless that it did not deserve strict handling. They did not consider it as an important thing. And on the other hand, they believed that if they did not stick to the traditions and religions of their ancestors, if they did not stick to their idol worshipping, it would be possible that the words of the Holy Prophet ﷺ deviated them from them. And this shows that they counted the Prophet's words really effective and serious. Brothers and sisters, we will continue our discussion about this 42nd verse of the chapter, God willing, in the next episode. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom, and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic and facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression. In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to push the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and wars since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Okay.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi-led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships, despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it is stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdullahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago, I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdullahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michel Aoun stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impacts on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Prime Minister Miqati, Abdullahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
The U.S. pressure and the Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living, this is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubayri, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdullahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feed stocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are in fact 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence. But it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
Rich countries must end all oil and gas production in the next 12 years, while the poorest nations should be given 28 years to provide a fair transition away from fossil fuels, according to a new study. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Matthew Taylor. The piece is titled, Rich countries must stop producing oil and gas by 2034, says study. Rich countries must end all oil and gas production in the next 12 years. While the poorest nations should be given 28 years to provide a fair transition away from fossil fuels, according to a new study by researchers in Britain. The report, led by Professor Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at Manchester University in northwest England, found that wealthy countries such as the United Kingdom, United States and Australia had until 2034 to stop all oil and gas production, to give the world a 50% chance of preventing devastating climate breakdown, while the poorest nations that are also heavily reliant on fossil fuels should be given until 2050. Professor Kevin Anderson said that while it was now clear there had to be a rapid shift away from a fossil fuel economy, it was essential this was done in a fair and equitable way. There are huge differences in the ability of countries to end oil and gas production while maintaining vibrant economies and delivering a just transition for their citizens, he said. The report examines each country's wealth and how dependent its economy is on fossil fuel production. It found that many poorer nations would be crippled economically and politically by a rapid move away from oil.